Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and it's time to take a look at your pet's health, especially during the kind of cold weather that we've been having, extremely cold temperatures. Dr. Bill Stork back with us. Dr. Bill, owner and operator of Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic, and as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in the conversation. Questions about dealing with your pet during this time of the year, or maybe another pet question, I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. Dr. Bill Stork, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Well, good morning, Larry. I always savor these sessions, but knowing that it could be our second to the last, it makes it even more special. How is that feeling to Larry?
Well, it's I'm of a couple of minds on it. You know, I'm looking forward to some of the things I'll be doing when I retire, but I'm sure going to miss the program. There's no doubt about that. And talking with you, as a matter of fact, and during this cold, I mean, we just experienced, I think, the coldest days so far this winter, and you get a cold snap like this, I imagine you see more cases of dogs suffering from exposure or extreme cold.
Well, is this discussion really even relevant anymore? Because, I mean, it was 8 or 10 degrees when I walked out of the house this morning, which is one of my favorite consequences of when we've been double digits below zero. All of a sudden, 10 degrees above zero seems like a heat wave.
It does.
Clearly the weather evokes a whole different set of considerations, including the old Norwegian saying there is no such thing as bad weather, just a poor choice of clothes. And no such thing as bad weather, just a poor choice of clothes applies to both ends of the leash, as it were. And I will say at the beginning and at the end, safety comes first, and it's especially for people who live in town. And sidewalks can be tricky because every house you walk by is going to manage their sidewalks differently. Some aren't going to shovel at all. Some are going to shovel, and that's great. But then when it gets warm during the day, you get a little melt on the sidewalk, and then it turns around and freezes at night, and you can be walking along on bare naked concrete. And the next thing you know, you've got a patch of ice. Then there are other folks who get very liberal with the salt, and that's a real set of considerations for your pets as well, because the salt can be a little bit irritating. And, you know, adjusted for size and breed. I mean, you know, if you have a 4.5-pound Chihuahua, it's an entirely different game. But for most dogs, they can do okay outside when it gets cold, but there are certainly some considerations, and the biggest of which is their paws on cold pavement or their paws on pavement that's been liberally salted. And they make a dozen different configurations of boots and booties that dogs can wear that can protect them from the cold concrete and protect them from the salt. And if that same dog is going to get off into the deep snow after that, then it gets to be a little bit difficult to keep those booties on. And I should have a photo or a video of my daughter's dog, because she has a full-on set of gaiters. So they come up above her hocks, above her elbows, and then there are suspenders that cross over her back. I mean, it's like a system. And you got to watch a video to learn how to install these things. But we took the dogs out Saturday and Sunday and ran all over the farm, and they're still in place. It's also worth taking into consideration that most dogs aren't going to necessarily immediately care for having boots on. They'll walk around like they're like a Muppet picking their legs up until they get used to it. So takes a little getting used to. And then, of course, there are coats and, you know, we dress in layers with an insulated, you know, with a base layer and an insulative layer. And they've got all of those configurations for dogs as well. Mm-hmm. But dogs do well in the cold. And it's important because it's just as, if not more important, to get them outside, socialized, exercised, and mentally and physically stimulated in the wintertime as it is in the summertime.
Yeah, it is. I've talked to people who just say, my dog will not wear those booties. Yeah. And there are some, if you just simply, if it's not going to work, aren't there some like waxy kinds of coatings you can put on the bottoms of the feet?
You bet. Things like bag balm, like we use on cows' udders, or there's a product called Musher's Wax. And Musher's Wax is pretty popular and does a really good job. And, you know, the other thing to take into account is ask your dog, because we try and put boots on them, we put Musher's Wax on them because we think they need it, but then you open the door and the dog goes flying out. Myself included, we have a tendency to get a little anthropomorphic at times, my dog doesn't want to go out for a walk, and we have to investigate that sentiment to see if it is the dog or if it's the other end of the leash that doesn't want to go out in the cold.
I saw a very funny video on Facebook of an owner trying to get her pug to go outside. It was just hilarious. The dog did not want to go outside, but
and let the record show, in any negotiation with a pug, the human is very poorly equipped and is going to lose that.
You know, here's an aside. You mentioned cattle, and I know you still work with a few farms.
I've almost given that up, Larry.
Yeah,
almost given that up, but for 31, 33 years, I absolutely did.
Did you ever run into problems, with cattle in extreme cold?
Of course, we ran into problems with cattle, but that's where modern agriculture comes into play. And people have a tendency to kind of categorically vilify these larger farms, but the environment and the environmental management on these larger farms is absolutely awesome. These cows don't know 12 below zero, because inside that dairy barn, where there's a constant 8-mile-an-hour breeze removing the excess moisture from those cows, and they know that it's, you know, 38 degrees in there, which is luxurious for a Holstein dairy cow.
And, you know, thinking about dogs again, some breeds are bred really for cold and snowy environments, are they not?
I always envy those guys. I mean, you take yourself a Husky or a Malamute or even Labs and Golden Retrievers, they can, and I marvel at this. These dogs can be laying next to the fireplace, get up, go outside and take a nap on top of a snowbank when it's 8 degrees below zero. And I have a rescue dog. His name is Wrangler. And Wrangler came from the plains of Texas. Literally, he was living with a herd of cattle. And they scooped him up, put him on a transport, sent him to Wisconsin. And that dog is probably sleeping on my front porch right now. You can't keep him inside.
It's amazing. You mentioned, you reminded me in your last couple of sentences about shelter dogs. And I expect you've treated, maybe surrendered, dogs surrendered to shelters sometimes at this time of the year.
Well, to some extent, but yeah, I mean, if it weren't for the South, especially Texas, I think Wisconsin wouldn't have any dogs, because the enormous, I think in our practice, we have somewhere in the vicinity of 4,500 dogs. And I'm confident that more of them came from rescues and shelters than came from breeders.
Yeah. Lila, rest her soul, was a wonderful dog that actually you treated at one point or another, and she came from...
Absolutely.
Loved that dog, even though she wasn't mine. Technically, she she liked being with me, and I miss her a lot, for sure. Well... you know, Huskies, I mean, don't they have kind of like a double coat or something?
They do, yeah. They have an insulative layer and guard hairs as well. Interestingly, we have a family, friends here at the clinic who have Malmutes, have had Malmutes for years. And when you see them walking their dogs in the middle of the summertime, they'll be wearing their winter coats. And gloves and hats. Because they want to know what the dogs are feeling and when enough is too much and it's time to shut her down.
Man.
If you didn't know what they were up to, you might think they were a little bit whacked, but it all makes sense.
Dr. Bill Stork, our guest today. We've started here by talking a bit about cold, but there are other kinds of health issues, I'm sure, affecting your dog. I hope you join in if you have a question or comment, maybe about the cold, maybe about something else. You can join in at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or shoot us an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking about your pet's health today with Dr. Bill Stork, owner and operator of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. It's great to have him back. And again, questions, give a call. The number 800-642-1234. You can email to talk@WPR.org. Somebody else just let me know that for cows, there's something called moose ears, I think, which are I don't know what they are, but they're little pieces of cloth that you put on the cow's ears.
Actually, I will amend that. And I was about to say that's new to me, and maybe that's more likely to be found on a hobby farm. But what I think they were alluding to is calves, because we'll put those on calves when calves are in hutches and in danger of being frostbitten.
Oh, very interesting. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, well, they make coats for calves too. They're very effective in maintaining their body temperature and continuing their weight gain.
Daniela in Green Bay has something for us. Let's go there. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, so my dog is about 50 pounds, and she really doesn't like wearing her booties. She'll kind of just stand there and not go anywhere. So I'm kind of wondering, you know, what we've sometimes tried to do is just take her out for really short periods of time and wait until, you know, she starts kind of hopping on her foot. And just pick her up and take her back in. But I don't know if that's sort of too much exposure to the cold.
And approximately what breed is she?
Yeah, we think she's like a lab beagle mix.
Yeah, okay. Another meaning of the mines, not dissimilar to the whole pug situation. But what I would do is I would outweight her, meaning... you know, you can lure her with treats. You know, if at 50 pounds, if it involves picking her up and carrying her outside, and I wouldn't pick her up and bring her back inside. I would wait her out, and you might offer treats to see if you can get her moving by using treats or just simply wait. I don't think she'll stand there forever.
Or maybe try the wax.
Or the wax, yeah. If she's not fighting to get the boots off, and if she doesn't fight for you to put the boots on, you've actually won two out of the three battles involved with dogs and boots. And I would, you can call it tough love or patience, but
I
would give her a little time.
All right. There you go. Thank you for calling. Marcia in Verona, your turn. Hi, Marcia.
Hi. I have a foster rescue, which she came from, or he came from Texas as well. Two things I want to say is there's no way I can put anything on his paws, but I shovel paths around trees so that we can, so that it's just easier for him to get to the areas.
Sure.
And we spend a lot of time at Mounds, Farm and Fleet, PetSmart, you know, just doing that when it's really cold. But my main reason for calling is he came with a really bad ear infection, and we're on our third course of 30-day kind of the medication that they put in the ears. And then we just started him on the Zenrelia.
Zenrelia.
Yep, which is giving him a little diarrhea, but I think it's getting better, and I'm going to go and get some, you know, probiotic powder today. But if all else fails, he may need one of those Tika procedures.
Okay.
Any thoughts on that or anything we're not doing? And he has been on several antibiotics, doses of the antibiotics and or you know, prednisone. We're all done with those things. We're just kind of wait and see. But I think the Tika may be the only way to really help this poor guy out.
Yeah, Marcia, and will he let you clean those ears?
No, you can't even. Yeah. That's the problem. Yep,
and therein lies part of the problem, because if we're not able to maintain them, then sometimes the procedure ends up being our only option. And it sounds as if you guys have been on oral medications as well as the in-the-ear medications.
What's the Tika method, Dr. Bill?
Yeah, it's a surgery for dogs that may have fairly narrow ear canals, in which case they open up the ear canals so that they're less likely to get infected and polluted.
Do they work pretty well?
Often, yeah.
No. Marcia, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's turn to Terry in Madison next. Hi, Terry.
Hi. I have a call. Well, I have a question about a product that your doctor just mentioned. It's called Musher's Wax.
Yes.
Yep.
Yes. And I have, I take care of a 17-year-old dog, and I have laminate floors.
Mm-hmm.
So 17-year-old dog has a difficulty kind of standing up at times and moving about. I have to have a special little carpet by her food so that she doesn't slip while she's eating. But because of the age of the dog and probably just more weakness in her legs, I just wondered if Musher's Wax would be a good possibility for the bottom of her paws.
Yeah, Terry, I don't think that would be a great option, because Musher's Wax, we think of dogs are going to be spending a lot of time outside and doing some traveling outside that's going to protect them from the irregular pavement. And I'm going to make a brave assumption that at 17 years of age, your dog isn't going too far. And then the Musher's Wax is going to be a little bit slippery, especially on laminate floors. To the extent that I would actually swing the other direction, and there is a product that I've been made aware of that I kind of scoffed at because I just couldn't see it being effective, but shut your mouth and open your ears and learn. And we've had a number of clients who have used these grippy stick-on paw pads for aging dogs with mobility issues. And a combination of those grippy stick-ons for their paw pads, and sounds like you've already incorporated some mats, some low-profile mats that have good traction, and essentially you make a path wherever he or she goes throughout the house, and that's going to help you quite a bit.
And what is it called? It's called sticky or
Yeah, it's Dr. Somebody's, and I can't remember the product. I have a picture of it in my head, but it literally is kind of a rubberized grippy pad that has adhesive on one side, and you can put it on all their pads. It may be enough to just put it on their central pad, and it will help prevent them from doing the Bambi on ice when they're on laminate floors and tile.
We can probably search around and find the exact name of that, Terry, but you could probably do that as well through a Google search. Dr. Somebody's sticky foot pad. Oh, boy. Thank you very much for calling. I think that's a great idea, maybe a great addition for Terry's old dog. Abby in Polk County, your turn. Hi, Abby.
Hey, hi. First off, Larry, I'm a longtime listener, but a recent caller, inner, and I just love you, and I'll miss you, so thank you.
Thank you.
So I have a beast of a dog. His name is Bear, and that's because he looks like one. And he's got a super thick coat, and he loves winter so much. And I kind of do too. But so he takes snow baths all the time. We live on a lake, so I kind of let him go this time of year especially. But he's got paws like elf, that old character. And we don't, to be honest, we've had him for 4 years, but we've never had him groomed. And I really wouldn't groom him, I don't think, but it's really hard just keeping him home through. But he seems to like be fine. I was just wondering, like, the paws, because he's had such long hair around his pads and stuff, and I know sometimes he'll scoot down and, like, bite the snowballs out, but he seems, like, I think the hair, that must be like a protector, though, right?
It is, but I think he's going to be just fine. If he would let you trim the excess fur, the fur that sticks between the paw pads on the bottom, and if he would let you trim the fur that overlies his nails, that could help a lot with those ice balls that get under their pads. But there are a couple of other things that could potentially be beneficial as well. Back to the musher's wax, yay. That might help prevent those ice balls from building up. And there's this other product that we'll recommend every now and then to the people who have springers and spaniels and golden retrievers that have feathers, who also like to pheasant and grouse hunt and like to get burdocks and stick tights and stuff like that. And that's a equine product called Shosheen or Cowboy Magic. And what Shosheen and Cowboy Magic are is like a spray-on conditioner, in which case, you know, if Bear's going to go out and take a nap in a snowbank, you can spray the bottom of his paws and it will slick up that fur and make it harder for the ice balls to build up, and they might just slide off.
Oh. Yeah, that's possible too. Another thought, Abby, for you. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. We were, I think Lee Rayburn might have been looking up some names on toe grips for dogs, and he found Dr. Busby's toe grips. Is that
it?
That's it. Dr. Busby's toe grips for dogs. Oh, and that's actually Joel Patnott, our producer, who did that work for us. So there you go. Dr. Busby's toe grips for dogs. And there's probably more than one listener who's got an old dog who slips and slides around a little bit. And Dr. Busby's toe grips are probably going to wonder, what the heck? How are we getting all these orders suddenly? Is probably what's going to happen.
Apologies to Dr. Busby for not remembering his name.
John in Wisconsin Dells, we'll turn to you now. Hi, John.
Hi. I live with a buddy. He's got an old dog. She's like 10 years old. She's like lab and something, but she licks her paws all the time, and she gets to the point where she can't can't even, she can't walk. Like, we literally got to pick her up, carry down the stairs, and then lift her back up to carry back upstairs. And that happens quite often, like maybe twice a month or whatever she gets like that.
And it's is it happening right now, by the way? I mean, is it any time of the year?
No. It seems to be, she just got over, tick, whatever,
Lyme disease.
Got bit by tick. Got over Lyme disease and took care of that. She took her medicine stuff, whatever. We're all done with that. But this happened before that too, though, where she can't walk at all.
Okay. And she's licking all four paws, John?
Mainly just the front ones, I think.
Okay. Well, two different directions I would potentially go with that. And the first place that I would go when I hear dogs licking their paws are allergies. And allergies, although they're more common in the spring and fall, they don't all read the book, and we will also see dogs that are profoundly allergic in the middle of the wintertime. And we have some excellent tools to help those dogs out. And if it is to the point that she's like licking the fur off of her paws, causing red and infectious lesions on her paws, then you're going to need more than over-the-counter Benadryl and Zyrtec and things like that. And however, there are other reasons why dogs will lick their paws. They can lick their paws because they're anxious, or they can lick their paws because they're sore. And we've got the complicating issue of the Lyme. And the Lyme could still be lingering, or she could have some arthritis. And I have your roommate check with his veterinarian, because there's a really good possibility some anti-inflammatories could be beneficial for this poor dog.
Yeah, I get him into the vet and have the vet take a look, because anti-inflammatories might be helpful. Good luck, John. Thank you for calling on behalf of your friend's dog. Lee in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Lee.
Yeah, thank you. I have a female cat. She's going on 17 years old. She had, for the last couple of years, renal kidney failure. She urinates a lot. She's gets the best of care with a vet. She lost her hearing roughly at least 2 years ago. Now, within the last couple of weeks, now she's lost her eyesight. Is the eyesight connected with the renal kidney failure? The loss of the eyesight?
Yeah, there are some mechanisms by which they can be connected, because along with renal failure, a lot of cats can have elevated blood pressure as well. And the elevated blood pressure can result in damages to the retina and the retinal vessels and cause them to go blind. How does she seem to be managing her blindness? As in, is she still able to find her litter box and her food bowls and things like that?
Yes. Yeah, she's doing well. I give her two different types of special, wet food for kidney failure. One is with Hills, and the other is, I don't know, I've got the can right here. It's one of those, the can here. Yeah, the wet food. Yeah, this is by Royal Canin. This is Royal Canin. And it's what they call a renal support D.
You bet.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And, in situations like this, we're always monitoring quality of life. Are we eating? Are we drinking? Are we eliminating? And a big one, can we rest peacefully? Because some dogs, some cats deal better with blindness than others. And we've known dogs that after they go blind, for whatever cause may be, they can't get settled. They they pace throughout the house, they run into walls, they get confused, and they become really, really anxious. If, on the other hand, you know, she or he is able to navigate and be at peace, then, you know, we're still doing well. And it sounds like she's eating well. That's a really good piece for a cat in renal failure.
Oh. Lee, does that help?
Yeah, that helps a lot. I know that probably there's nothing we can do for the loss of the eyesight. You know, my wife has looked into it. She's talked to the vet a lot about it because we have 9 cats. So I know cats.
You know what will be interesting, and this is charming beyond words, is whether the blind cat will develop a seeing eye cat, because we've heard solid stories from clients in which case a pet dog or a cat loses their sight. And another one will actually look out after them. Literally, that cat is walking towards the stairs, and another cat will cut them off at the pass. And sounds a little bit anthropomorphic, if not romantic, but we've seen it happen. No pun intended.
Yeah. And very interesting. Lee, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's turn to Perry in Oconto next. Hi, Perry.
Hey, Doc, and hey, Larry. Before I ask my question, that Shoshin works fantastic. I had American Water Spaniels, and they're like Velcro.
Good.
Well, I'll credit my wife with that one. She is the equestrian.
And anybody that has a hunting dog that goes into ticker or burdocks and stuff like that, boy, it works like magic. And Musher's Secret is the name brand of that Musher's wax.
Mm-hmm.
And I use a little battery clippers to clip the hair out of my Springer Spaniel's feet. So it works wonders. And it's very small, but you can find them. My question is leptospirosis. And it doesn't seem to be a core vaccine, but I understand that any dog that's by water or stagnant water is a real concern. And can you tell me about that? And is there any vaccine brands? I know everybody has a favorite. Some do better than others. What do you think, Doc?
Well, therein lies a bit of a different opinion among veterinarians. And here at the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic, leptospirosis is absolutely part of our core vaccine program for the exact reason that you just mentioned. Along with Lyme, one out of every 4 ticks in the state of Wisconsin is Lyme positive. And oh, by the way, we saw a young puppy last week with 4 ticks on it. So yes, Lyme, but lepto is probably the most prevalent organism that your dogs are going to run into, whether they're out in the woods or whether they are in town. And here's where I'm coming from. And back at the University of Illinois, there was a group of researchers a couple of years ago that went out and titered roadkill raccoons for leptospirosis. Now, how would you like that for your summer internship, harvesting roadkill raccoons? But they found like 97% of those raccoons were lepto positive. And lepto is shed in the urine of raccoons and possums and feral cats and deer and anything that crawls and roams around your backyard and out in the woods along the bike trails and the dog parks. And do we see those cases frequently? No, we do not. But when we do, leptospirosis can cause a raging liver and or kidney disease. So yeah, we're big fans of leptospirosis vaccines. And, you know, you asked specifically about a brand. That gets into splitting hairs, Zoetis, Elanco, who is the most effective lepto vaccine, but We recommend lepto vaccine for our patients.
Perry, there you go. There's the last word. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to John in Elkhorn next. Hi, John.
Hello. How are you?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
So my dog is a larger dog. She's a Great Dane Mastiff mix, weighs a little over 150 pounds. And she's 10 years old, and everybody keeps telling me, oh, no, you know, those dogs never don't live very long after 10 years and stuff. But she's very healthy, and I just wondered about diet, like if there's she has a really good diet now. I feed her she gets raw venison at least 3 times a week, along with dry food, carrots, and uncooked carrots and green beans. And I just wondered if there's other supplements or whatnot that could help her with her diet.
Man, John Satchel Paige said, how old would you be if you didn't know how old you are? And evidently, 150-pound, 10-year-old Great Dane Mastiff, you know, man, you guys are playing with house money at this point in time. Sounds like she is doing fantastic. As far as your diet is concerned, man, I wouldn't wiggle a single solitary thing. The vegetables, the venison, the kibble all sound fantastic. What I would give some consideration to at this stage of the game is there is a whole palette of supplements out there. And I'll use this opening to address supplements like glucosamine. For years has kind of been the cornerstone of joint supplements, glucosamine, MSM. Then there is eggshell protein and fish oils, fatty acids. Some people swear by turmeric, which I always pronounce incorrectly. All of those things, if given consistently, can be beneficial. The thing that we caution people on is that they're only appropriate if given consistently at an appropriate dose. And I don't trust food that includes glucosamine to have an appropriate dose. And the other thing to keep in mind is that there is no regulation when it comes to nutraceuticals and supplements. Or in other words, I mean, they could put sawdust and goat poop in there and call it glucosamine and charge whatever they wanted to. So you need to stick with a reliable brand. And Nutramax is the brand that we stand behind. But I would give some thought to doing some joint supplements and keeping her active. Motion is medicine.
Yeah, absolutely. John, thank you very much for calling. And Barbara in Fort Atkinson, we'll go to you.
Hi. Yeah, I have a very small toy poodle. And he has such bad breath, it's really wrecking my relationship with my dog. So I'd like to know if the doctor has any recommendations for bad breath in dogs.
Well, Barb in Fort Atkinson, how old is your miniature poodle?
He is 9 years old.
Yeah. My first, second, and third suspicion are teeth. And at 9 years of age, almost any dog is going to have some dental disease, some tartar, and probably some tooth root abscesses in there. The ultimate solution is likely going to be a dental procedure, which is going to be involved and extensive, but very, very necessary, because it's not just all about bad breath in relationships. And I mean, even a 4-pound toy poodle with a bunch of abscessed teeth, that breath can take over a room. But also the organisms, the bacteria that form all that tartar on those teeth, other places that those bacteria like to set up residence are like on the valves of the heart and cause heart murmurs, and in the kidneys and cause kidney disease. And if your dog has a mouth full of rotten teeth, which your nose is pretty much confirming, they're going to feel much better after that procedure. And very commonly, folks will say, oh my gosh, I'm a little bit concerned about putting her under anesthesia, because that's clearly an anesthetic procedure. It's a full-on surgery. And my answer is, your veterinarians are very concerned about that as well. And as a result, we all take extensive precautions. The dogs are on IV catheters and they're on inhalant anesthesia. They're intubated. We're pretty cautious about it. But your dog's almost 100% got bad teeth.
All right, Barbara, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Dr. Bill Stork, our guest today, owner and operator of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. He's also an author and a great speaker, as you're learning. I'm Larry Mueller for WBR News. We're taking a look at your pet's health today on the program with Dr. Bill Stork, owner and operator of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. At 12:30 today, we'll talk to Appleton native and biathlete Paul Schommer about his college coach, Chad Salmela, just days before Paul competes in his second Winter Olympics, and he's in Italy, so we'll be talking to him from Italy. Right now, we're in Wisconsin, and we're at Madison, and we're at Lake Mills with Dr. Bill Stork. It's great to have him back, and join in. Questions, give a call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Cheryl in Berlin, we'll go to you next. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. My daughter has a cat. She's about 5 years old. And I'd say for about the last 6 months, she has had very loose stools. Changing her diet didn't help. She's been checked out by the vet. And she goes to the bathroom in the bathtub.
Huh? She won't go in her box?
No.
Only go in the bathtub. Well,
Good.
Well, the good part is that you can at least turn on the shower afterwards, but that doesn't solve the problem.
No, yeah, what Larry said, and only joking around a little bit, because when cats urinate or defecate outside the litter box, that gets to be one of our biggest challenges. And at least it's taking place in a cleanable spot. And to be honest with you, Cheryl, in calls like this, I wish I could get called away on an emergency, because perpetual diarrhea in cats is one of those, we call them nebulopathies, those problems that can be chronic, reoccurring, and really, really difficult to get a handle on. And when they don't want to go away with diet change, and you know, on behalf of your daughter, I will say, when you change a diet, it also requires patience, because one, they have to be on the diet that you switched to exclusively for at least 8 to 12 weeks before we can say, yes, this is doing better, this is doing worse. In addition, if there are treats and supplements and canned food and stuff like that, that are part of the picture as well. Can't do that. We need to stick with the prescribed, presumably hypoallergenic diet. And there's a lot of other considerations in this situation. You know, is the cat thrifty? Is the cat in good body condition, energetic, active? Or is the cat lethargic, thin, losing weight, and poorly kept? But some of the things that can come into play when we work these things up are, especially when they're tenacious, obviously we do a fecal sample and do that in-house, and we look for any sort of parasites. There is a DNA test, a fecal PCR, that's an extremely sensitive test that we can send that off, and they can look for the DNA of something like 24 different parasites and organisms that can cause perpetual diarrhea. Then there's a CBC and a chemistry panel, so as to ensure that there isn't anemia, elevated white blood cell count, liver, kidney issues. And so frequently, we do all that work up, and the problem persists. And then the going gets really tough, and maybe that's where your daughter already is with this situation. But then we get off into some tough diagnoses, but hopefully you can get some, your daughter can get some help for a cat.
Yeah. But stay on that diet and don't give her anything else. That sounds like the message there, Dr. Bill.
You bet. Yeah.
Yeah. Cheryl, thank you for calling. Ron in Beulah, Michigan, your turn. Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. You guys have helped me with great advice keeping my Labrador retriever alive for the last year with the Librela for arthritis and food for kidney disease. He just turned 15, but we had another problem, either a bot fly or a pressure sore behind her right knee opened up suddenly. She just started licking it one night, and this big hole opened up in her leg. It was like a more than a half inch deep and three quarters of an inch in diameter. And so we put her on ampicillin for 20 days and then clindamycin for another 20 days. But then she started throwing up every time she ate the food with the clindamycin. So now it's been 14 weeks and it's two thirds healed, but it's still an open wound. And I've been putting mupirocin, I think it is, ointment on it.
Yep.
And just leaving it open.
Yeah.
And is there anything else that I could do at home?
Yeah. Is this a, Ron, is this a back leg or a front leg?
It's a front right leg.
Front right leg. And you say it's near the knee. So first of all, I share you and your veterinarian's frustrations because we see these barnacles in older dogs, and they can be one heck of a challenge. A thing that could be beneficial that could help potentially dry this up and scar this down, and especially if it's in a spot that you could put a wrap around it, like a little bit of a vet wrap and a Telfa pad, is either one, honey, or two, sugar. And for these opened wounds, honey and sugar can promote granulation and scar tissue and could help a bit. We're not going to make it go completely away. We're just looking to kind of manage and diminish it.
Yeah. Oh, there you go, Ron. Good luck. And thank you very much for calling. So apply some honey and then bandage it up, kind of, is what you're saying.
Yeah, just a light wrap in order to deter her from licking at it.
Ah, got it. Okay. Good luck, Ron. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Our guest today is Dr. Bill Storick. He is the owner and operator of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. Is that just a quick one here? Alan in Wisconsin Dells takes the dog out. It goes, but it'll just stay. At some point, it'll just stand there with one paw in the air. So he's put paw balm on it and all that. But he's wondering if it's okay to at that point, just pick her up and take her inside.
Yeah, you bet. And they're usually going to be better off. Like, I love the image that the lady not only shoveled the yard, which enough of us have done, but shoveled around the trees so that the dog could irrigate the trees. That is charming, to say the least. But oftentimes they do better in the grass or even light snow than they do on the pavement, because my theory is that the snow is 32 degrees. That's cold, but I'm confident that the pavement is much, much colder.
Dr. Bill Storick will be with us right up till 12:30. We'll take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us, and then we will be back. You stay with us. Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, looking at your dog and cat's health today with Dr. Bill Stork, owner and operator of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. Also an author, and great to have him back. Questions, give a call at 800-642-1234. You could email to talk at WPR.org. And let's take a call from Jay in Two Rivers next. Jay, hello. Thank you for calling.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I have two questions. I don't have the last veterinary report for our cat, so I don't know if he's been vaccinated for leptospirosis or if that's even a concern for cats. And he enjoys taking long walks when we walk our dogs at night. In the city, he follows us and sticks around, and I'm just wondering if you've ever heard of that.
That is the coolest thing I've ever heard. And first of all, with regard to the vaccine, we usually don't vaccinate cats for leptospirosis. It's not part of the vaccine. And I've heard it now three different versions of cats going for walks with their dogs, one of which was very good friends from here in town had two Mastiffs, Duke and Duchess, that collectively probably weighed more than I do. And those dogs were afraid of their shadow. However, their cat named Templeton, AKA Third Dog, when they went for walks, Templeton would be out front like the point of the arrow, clearing the way on the sidewalks while his 250 pounds of Mastiff trailed the owners, afraid of everything, including the cat. And we also have a friend here in town that has a cat that would follow the family wherever they went on their walks until, and he, I don't know if you've ever been to Lake Mills, but we kind of have a town square, which is actually a town triangle. And when they got to the last resident before the town triangle, before traffic got busy for Lake Mills standards, the cat would stop and just wait. And they could go across, they could go to the pharmacy public house and have food and beer. They could go to the grocery store. And when they came back, the cat would be waiting for him.
And now here's Jay with the cat following the dogs around.
And here's Jay with a cat following the dogs. So now we're up to three stories about cats around town. And I just think that's the coolest thing ever.
I do, too. Jay, thanks for sharing that. And I guess no on lepto for cats.
Yeah.
Yeah, there we go. Rich and Durand, your turn. Hi, Rich.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call. I truly enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I have I'm going to say it's about an 8-pound Chihuahua. I found her, or she found me, about 7 years ago. About 2 years ago, she developed, the best I could describe, is a sty on her right eyelid. I've been to the vet twice for other reasons with her, and I've asked them to take a look at it, and I've never really gotten a solid answer of what it is or what to do about it. It scabs over, but then at times if she rubs it, then it gets bright red. It doesn't seem to hurt her, or it doesn't affect her eyesight. At least it doesn't appear to. She doesn't complain about it, but I would really like to see if there's any type of ointment I should be applying to her, a warm rag or something to heal that once and for all.
Yeah, Rich, in order to heal that once and for all, to make it go away, would involve anesthesia and surgery. And oftentimes, and this will kind of dovetail with the previous caller, an 8-year-old Chihuahua is usually going to need some sort of dental work as well. And oftentimes when we do that dental surgery, we'll also surgically remove those little lumps. And there's a variety of things. I mean, warts, skin tags, there's fairly common lump called a meibomian gland cyst that behaves a lot like what you're describing. They're usually benign. Very seldom are they malignant. Very seldom do they spread, grow, or get bigger. And the urgency of the situation is oftentimes dictated with, does it actually contact the eye? And does it cause conjunctivitis? Does it cause the eye to be bloodshot, irritated, and things like that? And cosmetically, we don't enjoy it. But that's my take on those eyelid masses. They're pretty common.
And if you wanted to get them off, you probably do the teeth at the same time, you're saying.
You bet. Yeah, we like to economize our anesthetic efforts in these guys because, you know, it's extensive and there's a bit of risk involved.
Yeah, yeah. Rich, there you go. Thank you for calling. Mary in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We have a, well, it's a mix of a pit bull and a Staffordshire Terrier. And we got him through Humane Society last September. When we got him, he had like a kennel cough infection. He's been treated for that. It took like three different series to get everything cleared up. And then he still had a problem like with a nose running type thing. And he had what I guess they call reverse sneezes.
Yep.
And okay, which sounds absolutely terrible. But we're wondering if that, because now he has absolutely no problem during the winter months. So possibly it was an allergy issue. And if that's the case, what can we do if we have this same sort of thing crop up come spring?
So, Mary, with regard to the nasal discharge, is that continuous? Is it clear or cloudy? And is it from one nostril or both nostrils?
When he had it, he does not have it now. When he had it, it would be from one nostril, maybe a little more than the other, but kind of looked like both. And yeah, it was cloudy or yellowish.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, when it's cloudy or yellowish, we get more suspicious that it could be infectious, kind of like the kennel cough that you had a tough time getting rid of. With regard to the reverse sneezing, once a day, once every other day, three times a day, how frequently do you hear that?
Oh, not at all now. During the summer, probably a couple of times a day.
Yeah, so reverse sneezing looks pretty unsettling, sounds pretty unsettling, but it's spontaneous and usually resolves on its own. And yeah, when you put the things together that you've described, that they're more likely in the spring and summer when Wisconsin is green, then yeah, I would say that there's a pretty good chance that this is an allergic situation and maybe one that would respond to simple over-the-counter things like Benadryl or Zyrtec. And it's a great place to start. And so frequently people will say, well, my dog was sneezing and had runny nose, so I gave him a Benadryl or I gave him a Zyrtec. And I like to reverse that thinking. And if it's a time of the year and it's been demonstrated that that's what he's going to do, we're always better if we can get in front of things. And if he's demonstrated that, you know, 25 milligrams of Benadryl twice a day or 10 milligrams of Zyrtec once a day is pretty benign and could help.
And start earlier than later. Yeah. Now is now that, would she start now?
No, we should be okay for now.
But just wait maybe a month before or thereabouts.
Yeah, I don't see green grass anytime soon.
Okay.
Especially in La Crosse.
Yeah, that's true. Mary, there's your advice. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Dick in Brooklyn, Wisconsin. Your turn. Hi, Dick.
Well, thank you for taking the call. We have a 7-year-old German Shepherd, Australian Shepherd mix. And she has torn ACLs in both of her rear legs. we have decided not to pursue the surgery, not only because of the cost, but more so we don't think she's going to tolerate the recovery well, which is a pretty long and restrained recovery. But she still seems to have more good days than she has bad days. She's on some paid medication that the vet is helping us with. My question is, how is this going to progress, and how long is it likely to be that she gets to the point where she doesn't have more good days than she has bad days relative to her existence?
Yeah, Dick, really challenging situation, and I totally understand where it is that you're coming from, because you described, a German Shepherd, Australian Shepherd cross, which sounds like a active, purpose-driven puppy. And you are absolutely positively correct in the sense that the recovery from the surgery is a heck of a challenge. And we had one of our favorite, most ballistic Labrador retrievers that we've ever known in this practice that also had bilateral ACLs. And the owner soldiered through, but it required someone being with the dog 24 hours a day, and the dog had to essentially be sedated for 3 months.
Oh.
But on the other side of the surgery, and don't get me wrong, I'm not advocating for the surgery, but the dog did great. So it's a really difficult 3 months, but they can do well on the other side. So with regard to, you know, what is the trajectory going to be like here? You know, we've got a very active dog, more good days than bad days currently. You know, there's a lot of factors at work here. How active is the dog? The more active the dog, the more quickly the situation is going to degrade, and the more arthritis and destructive changes are going to take place in those knees. And it sounds as if the pain meds are helping for a while, but just based on what you've told me, not having met the dog, you know, I would think over the next year or so, it's going to progressively get worse and more uncomfortable.
Oh, Dick, there you go. Something to ponder. Thank you very much for calling, and good luck with your dog. It's always a tough situation. Jerome in Baraboo, we'll go to you. Hi, Jerome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Great program. One question, one comment. We have two cats, bonding pair brothers, Tabby, tuxedo tabbies, great cat. I was reading that they absolutely do not need grains or vegetables, and if you can get the highest protein type food, it is definitely best for them. So I'm just wondering about that. And also, Eddie is our fetcher, and is incredible. He has one of those foam lighted sticks, and it's just awesome because he'll actually push down on the stick to light it up, and I can throw it 10 or 12 times, him fetching it. And if I don't pick it up right away, just like a dog, he uses his nose to push it closer to me. So it's a lot of fun. thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, thanks for calling, and a great story.
Yeah, that is really cool. And, you know, for evidence, once upon a time here at the Lake Mills Veteran Clinic so many years ago, I got a telephone call from a lady who was certain that she wanted to convert her cat to being a vegetarian. And so I instructed her to open her cat's mouth and look at her cat's teeth. And none of those teeth are designed for processing grains, vegetables, grasses, or anything to that effect. So yeah, cats are obligate carnivores. No, they do not need grains whatsoever. And although it sounds like your cats are active, you know, they don't go pheasant hunting. They're not working cats all day, every day. So they don't really need the highest protein available. You know, good quality food, and there's 100 of them out there, but I don't think you need to deliberately seek the highest protein available.
Ah, there you go. Thank you. Kathleen in Fifield, your turn. Hi, Kathleen.
Hello, yes. I have a 12-year-old Samoyed, rather 11-year-old, and she has a small pimple-like growth on her neck. It seems to come to a slight point, and I saw black, little black flecks around in the hair, you know, around it. Anyway, what shall I do about that?
Well, it's pretty unusual for a dog to get to be 10, 11, 12 years old without having some number of barnacles from stem to stern. And what you described sounds for all the world like a wart. And we don't take them lightly. The factors that could elevate our level of concern with regard to that lump, that potentially a wart, would be, you know, is your 12-year-old Samoyed attracted to it, to scratch it, to lick it, to chew on it? That would be a sign that would elevate our level of concern. Is it growing rapidly? That would be a sign. Is it deeply attached? In other words, if you pinch beneath, easy for me to say, where it is it attached to underlying tissues? And I bet it's not. I bet it's a wart, and I bet you're going to be fine.
Yeah. It could be removed, I suppose.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, no problem there. Okay. Kathleen, thank you very much for calling. Bunch of emails, and I've been neglecting them, so let's go to a few of those. Susan emailed just to say this is for the dogs that have trouble walking on the hardwood and floors and so forth. She bought yoga mats and put them down, and they work great. Yoga mats work great. I like that suggestion. And Andrea emailed to say that Dr. Busby toe grips go over the nail itself, and they're not that easy to get on. The stick-on pads from Aquamax work great, but they don't stay on for more than 2 days. The paint-on sandy stuff is impossible to use. It just makes a mess. The stick-on pads would be perfect if they stayed on the pads longer, Andrea recommended cutting them separately rather than putting the whole stick pad on the bottom of the foot. So
it sounds like Andrea's got experience in this department. And like so many things with regard to those toe grips, here again, I've known dogs for whom they stay on, and these are the ones that go on the nail. I've heard of dogs for whom they stay on for a good long time and they are beneficial. And then I've heard others like Andrea mentioned, in which case they don't. I think it must be depend on what speed that dog goes.
Terry and Stoughton emailed to say they have a 4-year-old Great Pyrenees who absolutely refuses to get into any vehicle, hasn't had his shots for several years because he will not get into a vehicle to go to the vet. Do you have any suggestions to help change this behavior? Are there any vets that do house calls to vaccinate?
Yeah, there should be some.
She's in Stoughton, so near Madison, there's bound to be.
You bet. Yeah, there's a wonderful woman whose name escapes me in that exact neighborhood who does equine and mobile veterinary care. And Margaret. Is Margaret's Mobile Veterinary Care. And she is one, wonderful, and two, mobile.
Yeah, that sounds pretty perfect. Jeff emailed to say he has a 6-month-old Russian Belanka puppy and wondering when is the appropriate time to neuter him. It's 6 months old now. There's conflicting advice on the internet. One school thought says do it at 6 months. Others suggest waiting until he's reached full maturity. It's also a perspective that says don't do it at all. Apparently, a few dogs are neutered in Europe, and wondered if that's even true.
Yeah, you bet. Keeping an eye on time here because we're approaching 12:30, and lots of factors, one of which is the home. And, you know, if there are a number of kids roaming around, people coming and going, I would tend in the direction of the younger 6 or 7 months old neuter. When we start talking about delaying the neuter of the dog to 12 to 14 months of age, that research suggests that if we delay the neuter until after growth plates have closed, those dogs may be slightly less prone to hip and knee issues, like the ACLs that we heard about in the other dogs. A thing that I would caution is, if you Google it, you're going to get a big bunch of hits that come flying back at you that say neutering your dog early causes hip dysplasia and causes torn ACLs. In no way, shape, or form is that the case. It just makes them potentially, one qualifier, slightly, another qualifier, more prone to those things. But it's definitely not a direct correlation. So lots of factors, especially the family and other dogs and the dog's temperament, to be considered.
Amy in Milwaukee emailed to ask, how long is too long to keep a dog outside in really warm weather? Amy sees joggers in the summer on 80-degree and warmer days jogging for long distances. The dog's tongues are hanging out the side of their mouths, and it's hot on the pavement.
Yeah, and we'll look forward to those days. They're several months away, but we asked those dogs the same question that we ask, how long is it okay for them to be out in the cold? And in the cold, we look, you know, is their posture suggesting that they're cold? Are they shivering? Are they trembling? Are they getting small? With regard to the dogs that are outside panting, you know, they pant to dissipate heat, but if they are frantically panting, open mouth breathing, well, of course, they're open mouth breathing, but frantically breathing and breathing shallow, then they're generating more heat than they're dissipating, and it's time to shut them down.
Hmm. And one final story. Mary Locked, back in the 60s, she had a job in a high school working at a library, public library far from home. When Mary locked up the place at 9 p.m. to walk home, her cat Mickey would come out of the bushes and walk home with her. And when Mary graduated from high school and worked at the local factory for 18 months, Mickey showed up at the factory gate at 12:30 p.m. to walk home together. He'd see Mary to our yard and then run off doing whatever tomcats did in small towns at night.
Man, that is straight out of Harriet. That is awesome.
On that note, thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Bill. We'll look forward to your next visit. Appreciate it very much.
You bet. Take care, Larry.
Dr. Bill Stark, owner and operator of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. Well, coming up, we're going to take a look at the Olympic biathlon with one of the participants and his coach. That next. I'm Larry Mueller. The Olympics, they're on their way, and we're going to talk about them a little bit today. If you've ever, and in relationship to cross-country skiing, if you've ever cross-country skied like I have, you know, like I have found out, that physically, it's physically taxing. But now imagine skiing with a rifle strapped to your back and stopping to shoot distant targets. That's the sport known as biathlon, and we're talking with two biathletes. One, Paul Schomer, is a Wisconsin native now in Italy to compete as a biathlete in his second Winter Olympics. Paul Schomer, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me today.
I really appreciate you taking the time. Also with us today is Chad Selmala, a former U.S. biathlon team member and Paul's first biathlon coach at the College of St. Scholastical in in Duluth, Minnesota. And Chad, welcome to you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
As we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. Questions about maybe cross-country skiing or maybe biathlon. How do you imagine combining those sports? Give a call. The number 800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Paul, what time is it in Italy?
It is currently just after 7:30 p.m. here, so we're 7 hours ahead of you guys.
7 hours ahead. Well, you've been working and training there now for a while. How's it going? How are you spending your time there?
It's going pretty well. Thankfully, we got some fresh snow a couple days ago, which was nice. The valley I'm currently in was looking a little brown. Unfortunately, Central Europe, the part where I've been mostly this winter, isn't having quite the same wintry, cold winter that Wisconsin is having. But all in all, it's been good. I've been over here since October, traveling around, racing to the different locations that the World Cup has been on. And if there's one thing you get to know about biathlon when you ask a biathlete how it's going is if it's going well now, it might not be soon, as it's a very up and down sport. So definitely just trying to stay focused on the things at hand. But all in all, I feel like the team is in a good spot mentally and physically, and we're just
hoping for some medals. Oh, he froze up.
Yeah,
on
I mean,
his,
always,
oh, go ahead.
I think,
yeah, go ahead,
yeah,
Paul.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's always hope of winning medals at the Olympics, but they're the Olympics for a reason. There's a lot of really good athletes there, and nobody's going to just give them to you. So you got to show up ready to go, and we'll do everything we can, but we also know that there's no guarantees.
So maybe explain the sport itself or the contest, the Olympics part of it. It's an interesting sport for sure. I love watching it.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that I kind of want to start with is like the Olympics are probably the biggest event that we have in our sport. However, biathlon is a sport that competes every single year, and every single year we don't have an Olympics, we have a world championship. So it's a very popular sport in Europe, and as a result of that, it's also a very competitive sport, sometimes known as being one of the most competitive, if not the most competitive sport in Olympics, with the number of athletes represented and how close the field is. But it does combine both cross-country skiing and shooting. The competitions are a race, so the clock starts when you start the race, and it ends when you cross the finish line. And during the race, you stop and you shoot at the range. And every time you come into the range, there's 5 targets. When you hit the target, it turns white, and if you miss it, it stays black, which indicates that you're going to have a penalty, and you either get a time penalty added to your race time, or you have to ski a penalty loop, which results in obviously you having to ski a greater distance and having a greater amount of time on the course. So you really have to balance the ability to ski the course as fast as you possibly can, but also focus and hit all of your targets as efficiently as you possibly can.
It's amazing. Well, Chad, you coached Paul on the Nordic ski team at the College of St. Scholastica, where you still coach. You persuaded him to try biathlon. What made you think he would excel?
Well, he actually came into my office and he had read a book that a friend of mine had written about a young athlete who excelled very quickly in the World Cup level. I think that we both, looking back now, Paul having over a dozen years on the World Cup or about a dozen years competing as a biathlete, that book was probably not a realistic trajectory and time frame. but Paul saw the motivation to discuss it with me. And I was a national team athlete, raced in the World Cup, went to World Championships, never went to an Olympics, but I was coaching there, and he he asked me about it. And Paul was a very intense young athlete who knew what he wanted, and we didn't really go out and practice biathlon much while he was there. We did some shooting together. I think it gave him some foundational things to work on. But I could see very quickly that Paul had the probably the best ability of anybody I'd ever seen. I'd done a lot of coaching in a lot of camps with young athletes. I'd never seen anybody start hitting shots on a biathlon target as quickly and as easily as Paul did, and as accurately. It's a sport that takes a lot of time for most people to develop, but Paul was very quick at picking it up. And I was very close to the national team athletes and the coaches at the time, and I said I told them about Paul, and I said they need to get him when he graduates from college.
And they got you.
He did, yeah. Paul was an NCAA. He went to a D3 Division III school with no scholarship money, and we raced against Division I scholarship teams. In his junior year, he was a NCAA All-American, eighth overall, and he was only the second American in that field of eight, of that top eight. Everyone else was European.
Oh man! Has the sports, you kind of alluded to the fact that the sport has changed a bit over the time.
Yeah, I mean, I from my perspective, it's just gotten more competitive. It's tighter. There's more talent in the sport every year. More people want to do the sport. There's a whole there's like a minor leagues of the Biathlon World Cup called the IBU Cup, which is kind of like the minors for baseball would be, and that even that is a very competitive level. So it's hard for Paul to reach where he's reached. It's pretty impressive.
You and I got to go off a bit on your announcing ability. You are a very enthusiastic announcer and analyst of the Nordic ski events for NBC's Olympic coverage. How excited are you to do an on-air analysis with one of your former athletes in the mix?
Well, I've already done it, Larry. I've actually, in Beijing, Paul was in the lead of the mixed relay for a short amount of time, the first event of the Olympic Games. And I got to call his number on the Olympics. That was I've done that already. Now I just want to have a special moment. Hopefully I can call that as well.
Yeah, and what do you think of the prospects for Paul and the team?
I think Paul's in a really Paul made the hardest team to ever make for the United States, for sure. He's one of four, and the couple of the guys are leaving. Well, three of the guys are leaving home. All could have stepped in and done a good job. Paul made the team though, and I'm very proud of him for that. I think the fact that he made this team proves that he's probably at the highest level he's ever been, but the team is definitely at a high level. It's hard. I don't want to put pressure in, and Paul knows that I'm not trying to put pressure on him, but I do think this team has the ability to win more than one medal at these games. Biathlon is a thing that you might not win medals when you're favored to win every race. So, you know, take that with a grain of salt. It's not an expectation, but this team can come away not only with their first medal, but their second and third medal as well.
Oh man, that sounds wonderful. Well, I'm going to go one more with you. The most exciting call, and I've seen, you know, I'm an old guy, and I've seen many Olympics, and I've spent a lot of time watching the Olympics. And the single most exciting moment for me was your call on the U.S. cross country Olympic skier Jesse Diggins. I will never forget that, watching that in person, and your call of that made it even better than just watching. It was the most fantastic call I have ever heard, the most exciting call I have ever heard. And in my mind, it's the number one call I've ever heard by anyone for any sport at the Olympics. So that, here comes Diggins, here comes Diggins. Man,
thanks, Larry. Appreciate it. Thanks. Yeah. I mean, that was it was a special moment. And I think that obviously that's going to be my marquee call of my career. I don't think you can better that. I've often said you can live two lifetimes and never get an opportunity to call a race under those circumstances in which, first of all, it's a very exciting race. Jesse was up against the winner of the sprint the individual sprint race just a few days prior to the Olympics. So the gold medalist in the sprint is you're racing her, and she's racing the winner of the last Olympic gold medal from 4 years ago. And she's not supposed to outsprint either of them because she's not a sprinter, and she beats them all. And there was a sleight of hand that she pulled off there that I was carrying within me that didn't really make the moment of the call, but she had rope-a-doped those two athletes. Like, she pulled their sprint out of them, and it was an exciting thing to see. And I sensed that she could do it, but as she was doing it, I couldn't believe it. And I think what everybody got from me was a genuine reaction to what I was seeing, and you know, and in my own mind, not quite believing it myself, you know.
Yeah,
it's pretty great.
And I was fortunate to be able to interview her later on. She's a delightful person to talk with at the interview. Tom, and back to biathlon here for let's get back to that for a minute. Tom and McQuantigo has something. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Well, good afternoon, guys. Nice to hear from you guys, and I wish you the best of luck at the Olympics. I was fortunate enough to meet Paul up at Aaron's when they opened up the facility there, mm-hmm. and the rest of the, you know, the biathlon team that had come to do some roller skiing and stuff, and it was just mm-hmm. a lot of fun. One of the things I wanted to ask you guys is I watch a lot of biathlon on on YouTube. And like the latest round from what was it, Novi Mestro, the crowds were so incredible there in all the races in Europe. It's just a huge sport in Europe.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the most popular winter sport. It's definitely the most popular winter Olympic sport, and it's the most popular sport in the winter months. The number of people who tune into biathlon in Germany and France and Norway rivals the NFL in sheer numbers, but in terms of population to the viewership, it's every big as the NFL is on the American continent. So it's, you know, when Paul's over there, people know who Paul is, you know,
but not as much here in the US, Paul.
Yeah, not as much. I mean, first off, thanks to him for coming visiting up at Aaron's Nordic Center, which is a really awesome facility back in Northeast Wisconsin, which hopefully will give a lot more athletes the opportunity to try biathlon in the future. But yeah, it's definitely a lot different being in Europe and having biathlon fans who know the sport, are excited about it. But I also think one of the crazy statistics is like more people in the U.S. watch biathlon during the Olympics than most of the other parts of the world. So I think the U.S. has one of the most there's the most potential for growing the sport of biathlon in the U.S. than a lot of other countries that are already popular. So obviously we hope that success within the sport will help us grow and just connecting with people, because it is an exciting sport. Once you watch it, it is pretty captivating, and it kind of is really connected to some things that really make us all really human through the origins of the sport.
Yeah, absolutely. Tom, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Visiting today with a couple of guys here. Paul Schammer, a biathlete from Appleton, Wisconsin, heading to his second Winter Olympics in Milano, Cortina, Italy, next coming right up. He competed in the 2022 games. Chad Salmoa is head coach for the cross-country ski team and assistant track coach at the College of St. Scholastica in Duluth, where he coached Paul Schammer. And questions for them, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. You could email the talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk about healthcare sustainability. We'll get an update on the ice fishing season with the founder and president of Wisconsin Women Fish. And then we'll talk about some research on food waste in our state. Right now, though, we're taking a look at the Olympic biathlon with our two guests. Paul Schammer is going to be participating. He's from Appleton. Chad Salmala is head coach for the cross-country team at the College of St. Scholastica in Duluth, and coached Paul, and has been, how long have you been doing the NBC coverage? You got to be 20 years?
Yeah, 20 years. You hit on the head. I started in Torino in 2006. This will be my 20th year doing it. I didn't do cross country and Nordic combined at that games. I started that in 2010. So since 2010, I've been doing biathlon and cross country for NBC. So this will be my sixth game doing biathlon and my fifth doing cross country.
And you've done some announcing for the World Cup, other World Cup races.
Yeah, did one two days ago. I've been on all week, all winter long. I'm calling it from right where I'm sitting here and talking to you. So this is world headquarters for biathlon, English biathlon commentary.
And Paul, you mentioned, I wanted to ask you about training, and you did mention the Arians Nordic Center in Brilliant, Wisconsin. I mean, what's that center like, and how do you use it in your training, or how have you used it in your training?
Yeah, so I mean, Arians has been a team sponsor of ours. They've worked with us for, I think, ever since 2018 now. So it's been really awesome working with them for the last 8 years, and it's been an awesome partnership. And they went ahead and built a Nordic Center themselves, right in Brilliant, Wisconsin, which has full roller loop, snowmaking, and a 20-point biathlon range. Which is an absolutely incredible facility. It's something that I never thought I would see in Northeast Wisconsin. Just because growing up in the Appleton area, I didn't get into cross-country skiing until I was about 16, 17 years old, because there really isn't a culture of it at all there. So to be able to have that there now is really special. And I've spent some time there, they're training. I know that they have lots of camps, and next year I hope to be doing more to really work with the local community to help them see what they have available there and to build a stronger Nordic cross-country skiing and biathlon community for right in Northeast Wisconsin.
That's really cool. If you build it, they will come, as they and let's hope we get lots more people involved in it. Richard in Two Rivers has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Richard.
Hey, y'all. Thanks for taking the call. I drove out to Arians to look at the facility about a month ago, and had a very nice visit with the receptionist. And I was interested in doing it, but I have traditional cross-country skis. And she said, no, they generally do the skate skiing in the competitions and using the facility. So I kind of left thinking, you know, now I got to go out and buy all new ski equipment if I want to start the biathlon. Is that how it works?
Yeah. What's the technique? Paul, go ahead.
Yeah. So right now in all of our races, we do use skate skis. That's just kind of what biathlon has transferred to. Back in the day, they did do the more traditional style, which is also called classic skiing. We do use classic skis for training at times, so it's not unheard of. And you can definitely try biathlon using classic skis. That's not really a hindrance, unless you're using what they call clister, which is like a super sticky type of kick wax. The only reason why you wouldn't want to use that is because if you tried standing shooting and you were standing on the shooting mats with clister, you would get clister on the mats, and that would just become a messy situation. So it's not definitely unheard of, but I think the bigger thing with biathlon is you do need a biathlon rifle. So I think that would be the one item or one piece of equipment that you would need. But hopefully in the future, you have an opportunity where you can head back to Arians, sign up for one of their tri biathlons, and get behind the rifle and see try your hand at biathlon.
Yeah. And what are those rifles? It's not like the 30-06 deer rifle that a guy might take or a gal might take deer hunting.
No. So they don't use big bore rifles anymore. That's a thing of the past. We just use a 22 long rifle. Pretty much everybody uses the same manufacturer, Anschutz Fortner, with a slide action. It's just kind of the the standard that everybody uses. And then the stocks in which the action and barrel go onto are where the customization comes from. Every athlete is going to have, there's a little bit different, not only based on their shooting position style, but also just anatomy. My cheekbones are going to be a lot different than someone else's. Therefore, my cheek piece is going to be in a different spot. My arms, my hands might be a different size. So they are something that every athlete has to invest in. Every athlete has to buy their rifle, get their stock, and they cost, the action and barrel cost about $3,000. And then the entire setup with the harness, the stock, the sights, everything else, it's probably about a $5,000 investment plus or more when it's all said and done.
And with the World Cup races, I mean, those are they considered professional races? John wants to know. And you know, where you could win some money if you win the race.
Yeah, no, they're definitely a professional. It's professional racing with lots of prize money involved. So the International Biathlon Union has done a really great job of promoting the sport, and also have quite a bit of money because of the broadcasting deals and everything that they've set in place. So this year they just upped the prize money again. So for a standard World Cup, and we have 9 World Cups every year, and each World Cup has 3 to 4 races. So there's quite a bit of racing, and then at each race they pay out for the top 30. And the winner, I think, gets $15,000 for every win, and then goes down from there. So, yeah, the top guys are making a lot of and women. The what's really cool about biathlon is the women's side of the sport is just as popular, sometimes even more popular than the men's side. It's just as exciting, and they get paid the exact same as men in all of their prize money. But yeah, there's a lot of lot at stake. And so it's definitely a high level competitive sport.
And it's fun to watch. Connie emailed to say she operated her family's cross country ski resort, the Olympia Sport Village in Upson, Wisconsin. That's near Hurley, which hosted the Olympic biathlon trials in the 1960s. So she said, so there, the sport has a long history in the state of Wisconsin as well. Chad, comment on that?
I didn't know that. I do know Upson, and I do remember the Olympia ski area when I was a kid. I was from the Iron Range in Minnesota, but we'd go race the first races of the season as a junior when I was 14, 15 years old. And I would race in Ironwood, and in there's Wolverine in Ironwood. There's a ski jump there, and then we'd race in Wakefield at Johnson's Trails, and we'd go past that ski area every time. I had no idea that the Olympic Biathlon Trails were there in the 1960s, but that's a great piece of history.
It is indeed, and Chad Paul's the most successful skier to come out of St. Scholastica, I'm pretty sure. Do you point to Paul to inspire your other athletes there?
Absolutely. I'll make a point. I haven't been the ski coach in 10 years. I'm still the cross country running coach there, but I'm next to the ski coach. Yeah, so we're very connected. We have had one other All-American since Paul left. So we still have very high level skiers, but Paul still remains the Olympic athlete that came from our program still. And we do have an Olympic bronze medalist hockey player from St. Scholastica for women's hockey. It's from Switzerland.
Well, I tell you what, I want to thank you both for taking time to be with us. And Paul, especially 7 o'clock at night, you probably might have had better things to do, but I really appreciate the time that you took here today. And really, really, I'll be watching. You know, really good luck in the coming Olympics. When is the first event for you, by the way, in the last second here?
Yeah, so the first event for biathlon is on February 8th, the mixed relay. And there's a lot of races at the Olympics. I think there's 10 race days of the 14 days for the Olympics. And, really, really thankful to be here. And me and my teammates are going to do our best to give Chad something to be excited about.
Okay. Paul Schaumer and Chad Salmala, head coach for the – Paul's the head coach or was the head coach for the – of Paul – as he worked on becoming a biathlete. And a big thanks to both Paul and Chad. And thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots more at Story here on WPR News.